Can everybody? Okay. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
Okay, great. So let's open with a word of prayer and we'll begin. I know that Dan just prayed, but let's pray one more time. Can never pray too much when you're doing a study. Our Father, we just come before you and we just thank you and praise you that we can open up the Word of God. We are so grateful, Lord, that you've written these things down for us, that we might grow by appropriating your word and faithfully applying it in our lives. And we give you thanks and praise for your grand plan with respect to the nation of Israel. As the King James says, these are promises given to Israel that will not be repented of, ever be taken away. So we give you thanks and praise in Jesus' name. Amen. As we continue in Exodus, we find in Exodus 19 that we're at the base of the Mount Sinai in the wilderness of Sinai. Just shows a picture here that kind of gives an idea of just how barren this place really is. Lord, was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over? Just a map here. Sinai is at the bottom there. And the children of Israel are 3 days into the journey after leaving Egypt. And effectively, this is an 11-day journey that could have been made, but the Lord understands that they're not morally mature enough to enter into the promised land. Earlier in Exodus, it says that the Lord, if they went on the 11-day journey, they would have encountered the Philistines. And if the Philistines had attacked, they probably would. They would. Another picture of how barren this place. This is the wilderness of Shur, a little north of Mount Sinai. But can everybody hear me well? I get a little note said my internet was unstable. Are we doing okay? Please let me know if you can't hear me well.
There was just a little gap there, but you came back up,
Yeah,
so.
please let me know. I'm right by my router. Sometimes in our Friday night study, I have that happen too. So just let me know. I put up this slide before, but I don't know if you can see this, but this connecting phrase in the observation of the book begins with the conjunction and emphasizes the fact that Exodus was never intended to exist separately. It is thought of as a continuation of a narrative. It picks up the storyline that began in Genesis and was completed in three more books, making up the first division of the Hebrew canon known as Torah, or meaning law, instruction, and teaching. And this is essentially what Moses is doing, beginning in 20 and then going forward. He is teaching the people information, specific instructions that he's received from the Lord. Since the second century, this happens to be known as the Pentateuch. In the beginning of Exodus, we see this first example of practice that appeared in almost all the historical books of the Old Testament, the use of the simple conjunction and to begin a book. Here are some other books where this occurs. This feature appears to indicate that the writer was conscious of the fact that he was contributing to an ongoing sequence of revelation and narration. In just a couple more things in the Pentateuch as a whole, there are six major themes. Today, we would be looking at God's revelation of himself in covenant, law, and tabernacle and tabernacling presence at Sinai. So the instruction begins specific laws given to the nation of Israel to set them apart. They are a peculiar people. And you can look at some of the other things that the Pentateuch features here. It's important to keep in mind that Moses is writing at the end of his life to the Exodus Jews, the children of Israel. Why? To remind them of where they came from and that it is God who has separated a people to himself, the Israelites, the apple of his eye. There are three basic lessons which are encompassed in these Exodus chapters, really Exodus 21 through 23, these ordinances, which have tremendous relevance to our lives. Because sometimes people read the Old Testament and think, well, you know, these are, what is the relevance today? And effectively, it's these three things: the Lord's deep concern for fairness and justice, the Lord's deep compassion for the poor and oppressed. And number three, a consecration, his concern with or a desire for a consecration of self and resources. I'm gonna end there. We'll go back to our basic picture. And I'm gonna pick up with my notes here. And we will begin then. So we have the giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. They are written in stone, literally. Someone can say this about the law, that the laws that are given, the 600 or so laws, first the Decalogue, the first 10, and then many, many others after that, are rigid and uncompromising. That's the law. And Paul describes it as a ministry of condemnation. But effectively, there is a fair amount of grace in these laws. We can think of provisions where when someone is harvesting the field that the Lord has given them, to leave extras at the corner for the poor and the needy. There are provisions that we can see when there is need. And we can see that there are provisions even on the Sabbath where work has to be done. So the circumcising of a child, let's say. And the Lord understands those things. But we find these first 10 commandments, four of which relate to our relationship to God and six relate to our relationship to man. And these apply to practical situations, and Moses is going to begin with this application, keeping in mind that there are more than a million people that are going to enter into a land that God has given them. There has to be structure, there has to be order, there has to be a way of living that pleases the Lord and that he has provided for them. So chapters 21 through 23, we'll do 21 tonight, very practical. The questions that relate and that are addressed are, what does loving my brother mean if we are slaves, if I have slaves? How does one handle violence among God's people? How should animals be treated? What is a fair punishment for the thief? Etc., etc. These are practical things in a large community on how to live in a way that pleases the Lord. So there is a sense in which the verses in chapter 20, verses 22 through 26, are an introduction to a huge body of material we're about to consider. Let's look at Exodus 20, verse 22. Don't have to turn there. It says this. Then the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, you have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. So the fact is declared. Moses is Yahweh's spokesman, and Yahweh considers that role settled. From this point on, God will speak to Moses, and Moses will speak to the people. And so in Exodus 21:1, the section on the ordinances has a comforting promise about God's directing his people into the promised land where the laws just stated would be practiced. It contains promises of cursings for disobedience and blessings for obedience, similar to those in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And while most of these laws may appear irrelevant to us, they were the glue that bound this people together as a community. So just some background as we look into specifically Exodus 21 tonight. So let's start with the first 11 verses. I have the New King James Version, and I can read these here. So verse 1, Exodus 21, New King James, it says, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. Lord speaking to Moses. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. Verse 3, if he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Verse 5, but if a servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Verse 7, and if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has deceitfully dealt with her. Verse 9, if he has betrothed her to his son, He shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. Verse 11, if he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. So it's important to not to read the Bible with 21st century eyes, and this chapter is no different. Slavery was a prevalent thing. And if the Lord is going to create a peculiar people for himself, a people that he loves, and that where love is the basis of treating one another, how can this be done if someone has slaves? Notice that in the portion it says we're talking about Hebrew slaves here. So slavery was prevalent. How does one treat slaves in a manner that deals with this reality and yet stands out as being humane and loving given the circumstances? And so Paul himself mentions very interesting things on slavery. And slavery was a common practice in the Roman world. Someone emphasized that as many as 50% of the people in the Roman Empire were slaves. So this is a very, very prevalent thing. So the subject of verses 1 through 11 is regulations governing the rights of male servants, verses 1 through 6, and female servants, verses 7 through 11, Hebrew slaves. The key is that these slaves had basic rights of fair treatment under God's rule. Among the Israelites, a person could sell himself and his wife into slavery due to poverty or debt. We've got a couple of references, Leviticus 25:39, Deuteronomy 15:12. There's another one in 2 Kings 4 and Nehemiah 5:5. But the point is that the servitude was to be limited to 6 years. Thus, it was indentured servitude. This isn't something that would go on forever. It was something to solve a practical issue, debt, poverty. Further, a master was obligated to provide for his servant on his release. Deuteronomy 15, verses 13 to 14 talk about that. If a male servant wanted to remain in permanent servitude, his request was to be validated by the judges, and then one of his ears was to be pierced with an awl to symbolize willing service. Psalm 40, verse 6 mentions this. And a female servant could do the same. So we have treatment here under a circumstance that's less than ideal, someone being someone else's slave, but it's treatment that would be honored, and it would stand out among the peoples, especially in the land of Canaan, if this were implemented as being different, certainly. That is the point that the Lord is making through Moses. Remember, it's God giving the law to Moses, to angels who gave it to Moses, who gave it to the people. Galatians mentions that lineage here. And Moses is setting this in place so that this would be observed and people would live together in a manner that would please the Lord and have peace and harmony here. Let's look at verses 7 through 11. Female slaves were treated a bit differently. Notice that even Abraham in Genesis 21, verse 14, didn't do this with Ishmael's mom. He grabs her by the arm, gives her a wine skin of water or a skin of water and a loaf of bread and just shoves her out the door. And then the angel of the Lord finds her there, basically when the water runs out, the food runs out, crying underneath a tree. This is the Lord wants, fair treatment here. And so, and again, the Lord presents his servants, warts and all. So many times female slaves were concubines or secondary wives. We have many, many indications of this, Genesis 16, 22, 30, 36. Some Hebrew fathers thought it more advantageous for their daughters to become concubines of well-to-do neighbors than to become the wives of men in their own social class. Again, practical needs, the decisions of a father. If a daughter who became a servant was not pleasing to her master, she was to be redeemed by a near kinsman, Leviticus 25. Remember, this is what Boaz was waiting for, right? Boaz is a man of honor. He's waiting for the kinsman first in line to perform his obligation. That man does not, and Boaz steps in and redeems Ruth. But so these things in the book of Ruth at least were being implemented or at least being honored here. If a daughter became a servant was not pleasing to her master, she was to be redeemed by a near kinsman, but never sold to foreigners. Exodus 21:8. She could also redeem herself. If she married her master's son, she was to be given family status, verse 9. If the master married someone else, he was required to provide his servant with three essentials: food, clothing, and shelter. Marital rights probably means living, not necessarily anything to do with sexual privilege. It's interesting that in today's society, in the US society, I don't know if you know this, one of the categories of poverty is newly divorced women who may have spent their time raising kids, so they might have been out of the job force or workforce for a long time. They get divorced and their poverty level goes down. So these things do have a practical impact on our modern day society. The issue is treating people fairly, providing for them, making sure that if something occurs, there is a provision that is made. And of course, much of our laws are based on, our common law is based on biblical principles, trying for fairness. So we've covered the first 11 verses here. Any thoughts or questions here on this topic?
What does this have, Ray, in relation to the year of Jubilee? Is that of any relation to that time frame?
Well, the year of Jubilee was a release, certainly, where the land was returned. And I think within the scope of the idea that the Lord would give release, I think that you could say that this is a subset of the ideas that the Lord is implementing. I don't know, maybe Jeff has an idea on that. But basically, the Lord is looking for equity and fairness. Certainly, and he keeps in the year of Jubilee, reminds the people that the land is his.
Thank you.
So, without any other input, well, let's just go to verses 12 through 17. This is the statutes of capital offense. Now, remember, we have the Decalogue that's given, but then now we have criminal, civil, and ceremonial law. So, the law in its totality, once fully implemented, impacted every aspect of an Israelite's life. So verses 12 through 17, let me read them again, the New King James here. Verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies surely shall be put to death. 13, however, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. 14, but if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. Verse 15, if he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. 16, he who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. 17, and he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. So we've got some pretty blunt instructions here. And this is, of course, what Jesus, in his dialogues with the Pharisees, was addressing. His basic point to them was, you've encrusted the law with your rabbinical commentary and thus blunted the direct effect of the law. For instance, in the Sermon on the Mount, as he lays down the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, for instance, in 6 and 7, he begins to expand, and he uses this preface. You've heard it said by those religious leaders, but I'm telling you, I'm directly telling you what the law says. And it is direct and at times extremely uncomfortable, but this is a measure of God's holiness and fairness. And so he lays this down. These verses address four crimes that require the death penalty. The first one is premeditated murder, verses 12 and 14. The sixth commandment in Exodus 20, verse 13, and Genesis 9, verse 6. Remember, the Lord implements capital punishment in Genesis 9, taking a life for life. The second one is physical violence against parents, Exodus 21, verse 15. The third one is kidnapping, verse 16, also Deuteronomy 24, verse 7. Deuteronomy is essentially the restatement of the law as Moses is on the plain there. He's restating the law to them, repeating, repeating. This is what Mishnah means. We have the Talmud and the Mishnah. Mishnah, the repeating, 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 learning by rote. This is what was rabbinical students are taught, or at least in Jesus's time. Actually, I remember when I was in high school, we were forced to read The Chosen. I don't know if you ever read that book. The Chosen was a book about two rabbinical students. I can't remember who wrote the book, but in that book, these two very bright rabbinical students or high school students, very bright kids who go to rabbinical, or I should say, go for Talmud studies after high school, or their day in high school ended, and they were memorizing huge portions of the law, huge portion of the law as well as rabbinical commentary, and the book kind of outlined what the life was for them. You know, those who were Torah observant, those who attempted to follow the law as best they could. So, premeditated murder, physical violence against parents, kidnapping, and verbal abuse of parents, Exodus 21, verse 17, and cross-referencing the fifth commandment in Exodus 20, verse 12, and also Leviticus 20, verse 9. Allowance was made for unintentional accidental deaths. Verse 13, a guilty person could escape to one of the six cities of refuge after Israel was in the land. And because of the importance of the home, its sanctity was guarded, parents protected, and children controlled. Disrespectfulness was to be dealt with in the same manner as murder. So God's not fooling around here. Notice how, when we are looking at these practical applications of the law, the implication here is that these things do go on, they do occur among Israelites. God is dealing when these things, when they do occur. He's not stating, he knows human nature very well. It's interesting that when I was in high school, another high school story, maybe you had this experience, but there were several high school teachers that deeply impacted me, and one was a history teacher, and her father was an attorney, and during World War II he joined the army and was involved in. It had to be the army. I think it was the army, not the Marines. But anyway, he was involved in the second wave after the invasion of Normandy. And he asked, what is an attorney? Maybe what was he doing? Having a machine gun in his hand or a fire flamethrower or something. But actually, he was practicing law. And when they would go in on the second wave, they understood that soldiers, basically an army is a professional corps of officers with basically high schoolers, basically commanding high schoolers, 18, 19-year-olds, whatever. And under the circumstances of war, the pressures, all of that, as you go in, as they were invading, they were going into communities that had been ravaged by the breaking of institutions and all sorts of things. And so the army would bring in and implement their regulations and basic U.S. laws to deal with circumstances that would come up, very difficult situations and such, to implement order. And of course, they had military police and such. So, in this particular case, again, God establishing rules for order and proper living. And our time is moving rapidly here. Let's look at verses 18 through 27. Verse 18, Exodus 21, let's read this. If men contend with each other, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed. If he rises again and walks out, about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. Again, issues of justice and equity here. Verse 20, and if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. 21, notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. 22, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly, as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. So we have regulations concerning several civil deviations. I should say regulations concerning several civil deviations are given that were not severe enough to merit the death penalty. You know, it's an interesting point that Wisconsin, for instance, does not have capital punishment, right? And yet one time it did have capital punishment. And I had read that the reason why the putting to death of a man in Wisconsin stopped was that there was vigilantism, and that people had gone too far in implementing that. Now, this is what I read. I mean, maybe somebody knows Wisconsin history better, but basically they took that away because of the uneven treatment of it. I'm not advocating for or against. Of course, the Lord provides for capital punishment. But the point of the matter is that, again, it's the implementation of these things. And what is the Lord doing here? He's putting kind of guardrails in place so that if retaliation does occur, it goes only so far and it is in proportion to the crime that has been committed or the accident that has occurred. The Lord is, again, cognizant of the behavior of sinful individuals who will then enter into the land, again, a peculiar people with its own laws, meant to not only just provide for peace and order, but be a light to the world. Israel was charged or elect to carry the word to the world through its example. So in a physical quarrel, the injured party, whether or not the injury was premeditated, was to be given compensation for his loss of work time while he was walking around outside with a staff and for medical expenses. Verses 20 and 21, slaves were not to be treated cruelly by their masters, though they were considered property. If a master beat his slave and the slave died, the master was to be punished, but probably not by death. However, if the slave soon recovered, no punishment was to be exacted, for apparently the point is that his intention was not to kill that individual. So laws with thought in terms of the weight of punishment to be given for these circumstances. The loss of a slave's work was his master's loss, and he was to be compensated for that. In verses 22 through 25, if a pregnant woman delivered her child prematurely as a result of a physical assault or a blow to her body, but both were otherwise uninjured, the guilty party was to pay compensation determined by the woman's husband and the court. However, if there was injury to the expectant mother or her child, then the assailant was to be penalized in proportion to the nature of severity of the injury. Again, fair justice is the standard here. While unintentional life-taking was usually not a capital offense, verses 12 and 13, here it clearly was. Also, the unborn fetus is viewed in this passage as just as much a human being as its mother. The abortion of a fetus was considered murder. A person's physical loss by injury was to be punished by a similar loss to the offender, verses 24 and 25. The law of retaliation, Leviticus 24, 19 and 20, Deuteronomy 19, verse 21. This law was designed to restrict the exacting of punishment to what was equitable. Tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye. Again, Lord, conscious that in anger and in retaliation, it could go too far. Very much like when the Lord is describing, again, in the commentary to the Sermon on the Mount, what anger can do. Anger can quickly get out of control. So the Lord is addressing the root cause of this. Control your thought toward an individual. Understand the severity. And as the Pharisees, as opposed to the Pharisee the law was quite serious, and it was and to be treated that way because it dealt with human nature and the tendency that we have. Verses 26 and 27, the law of retaliation. This, however, did not apply to a master who injured his servant. Any permanent maiming of a slave would result in his being legally freed, and the master must let the servant go free. So in this particular case, the master wasn't injured in the same way. He just had to let the slave go free. Verses 28 through 36, I know it's very detailed here, but I would like to cover this chapter. Verse 28, Exodus 21. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past and has been made known, and that's been made known to his owner, and he has kept it confidential or confined so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life, whatever is imposed on him. Verse 31, whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. Verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Couple more verses. 33, and if a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls in it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his. 35, if one man's ox hurts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox shall also they shall also divide it. 36, or if it was known that the ox tended to thrust in time past and its owner has not kept it confined, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his own. Here, these statutes were given for cases involving injury through negligence. I think every tort lawyer in the US starts to perk up when he sees this. This is the basis, probably, for a lot of the tort law that we have. Tort meaning wrong. So first, God gave regulations concerning injuries inflicted by animals. If a bull gored someone to death, the animal was to be killed. However, if the animal had a habit of violently attacking people and the owner did nothing to prevent it and someone was killed, the owner as well as the bull was to be put to death. Pretty serious. He could avoid the death penalty if he could come up with financial compensation demanded by the dead person's relatives. If a slave was killed by a bull, the animal's owner had to compensate the slave owner by paying 30 shekels of silver. Matthew 26, verses 14 through 15, the Lord references the pulling out of an ox on the Sabbath day, showing mercy. Apparently, this was the price of the slave. I'm sorry, Matthew 26, 14 through 15 talks about the price that they put on Jesus. Second, in the event of animal loss due to someone's negligence, example, not in covering a pit you perhaps usually use to collect rainwater or for some purpose to prevent an animal from falling in, the guilty party was required to render full compensation for the loss of the animal. Here, this regulation was important because animals were important property of the Israelites. And then finally, third, if a bull killed someone else's bull, the loss was to be shared equally between the owners by selling the live bull and splitting the money. Verse 35. However, if a man knowingly neglected to pen his goring bull, then he must pay for the dead bull. So again, equity and justice, fairness. So as we come to the end of the time, I wanted to go through the basic conclusion for the passages that we're reading, and a conclusion, several conclusions we can keep in mind as we go to chapter 22 and chapter 23. While most of these laws may appear irrelevant to us, they were the glue that bound this people together as a community. As I read before, there are three basic lessons which encompass these ordinances and which have tremendous relevance in our own life. Number one, God's deep concern for fairness and justice. Number two, a compassion for the poor and oppressed. And finally, three, a consecration of self and one's resources, of course, those resources having been given by the Lord. I think I'm going to stop here for Exodus 21 and leave it open for any potential questions or comments. So much more to be said here. Time flees so fast.
What do you think is the relevance for that, the 30 pieces of silver that was given to Judas for that he betrayed, the 30 pieces of silver that Judas betrayed Jesus, and then the cost of a slave, the death, the life of a slave?
The price of a slave, that's what they compensate, or I should say that's the value they put on Jesus. But it's a slave was property, so just fair compensation. You know, obviously I don't know how 30 shekels was arrived at. I know that the shekel was a unit of value that didn't change essentially, but the, you know, effectively, it appears to me the implication is it's not a tremendously high price, but it's a price that is costly enough to impose some cost on someone that would be a cost that at least would pinch or hurt in some way, but not something that would be overwhelming. And I don't know, maybe Jeff knows more about that than I do, but that's the implication there. And of course, the low value that they placed on Jesus, fast forward.
That, what is it, AWL, how do you say that out?
All, yeah.
All, that they, was that very painful?
It's a sharp stick or metal, and it was just to be plunged into your very quickly. So that, you know, like an ear piercing, I suppose it's painful for a short period. When I first got saved in the mid-90s, there were guys that would wear earrings, and sometimes there would be older, maybe more mature believer, I don't know, whatever, would come down on them. And I remember one guy quoting this passage, well, here's the justification for my earring. I'm a slave unto Christ. And I thought, that's clever. I thought that was clever. I'm not saying anything about earrings. I just think I thought it was funny. They always had, these young guys always would have a verse, you know. But
say, Ray?
Yes, Fred.
Can you show us the rest of your PowerPoint?
I don't have... I have my notes I could share with you, but you mean go back to the PowerPoint?
You've got some slides you didn't present, I think, or not?
No, I read from every single one. There's just a few. This is the conclusion.
All right, good.
Yeah. Anyone else with thoughts? Okay, I'll turn it over to Fred then. Thanks for your attention.